2, 3, 4. Testing. 1, 2, 3, 4. This is Monday evening, September 13th, and it's the alumni meeting of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. There will be a reminiscence or storytelling by a member of each of the of a class from each of the decades, from the 1920s to the 1970s.
I came to the Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines in 1927, mostly to play basketball, and I would never have amounted to much as a student if I'd played more than 1 year here. The chemistry professor made it possible for me to get a good grade in chemistry and be absent for 6 or 7 weeks during the school year to play basketball. I'm not uniquely qualified to speak about the 20s, but I had a sister who was 10 years older than I was. She's the mother of Carol Allison and the grandmother of a couple of kids here tonight. And she brought me the news of the Young College every day. And it was filled with all sorts of excitement because she, like at least 90% of the original students, had no chance of a higher education because of circumstance. And if you look at the roster of the students who attended here in the early 20s and later on, most of them came from Fairbanks. And it was only by the good graces of someone that they managed to have a graduate every year or so. Finally, about the time I arrived, they were putting out 2 or 3 students a year, and then more and more each year. And the life on the campus at the time seemed to center around the 3 Loftus brothers and the 2 McCombs, as far as I was concerned, because they played basketball at the university or then the college. We did not have a gym, as you'll notice here. This segment of the building was not put on until just before my arrival. It sort of matched this one, and that was this gymnasium. At the original time I came to the college, my dad thought it would be better for me to live here on the campus than to live in town with the family. So I was packed up and put in the men's dormitory, where I found it's somewhat easy to live away from home because I had my home just a few miles away on the Brill car. There was an entrepreneur here named Thompson, who later went into the diplomatic corps, who had a taxi cab that would take the students whenever they got loaded to town. I would say that the drinking on the campus was very moderate at the time, but Judge Bunnell was so severe about drinking that it was with the extreme trepidation that we would take a drink on the campus. In fact, he was so bad about it that my sister's wedding was absolutely dry, and that is not much of a thing in the Romick family. So we went to the 18 Mile Roadhouse. My sister, who married Art Daly, who was a young engineer for the FE company, we had a dry dinner and a dry wedding reception at the 18 Mile Roadhouse. This was out of respect for President Bunnell. I would say that the university had many, many trials, and there was a very hard struggle for President Bunnell to keep it going. And this is all a matter of history and has been written now in books. I think the most significant historian to this point in time of the university is represented in Bill Cashin, who wrote, "As everything seems to be in Fairbanks, the farthest north, something or other," and it was the farthest north college president. They had a contest in Fairbanks once to name the new golf course they were going to build on somebody's farm about 9 miles from town. And the person who won it said that the name should be the Farthest North Golf Course. So this is an old cliche that we have here for the all of our institutions. Fairbanks seems to be a few miles north of Rome, so we can always claim to be farthest north. Now, what I would like to say about the university as it was then a college, that it was just barely a step above high school. And they had about as many professors as they had students. They didn't have a whole fistful of degrees like they do now. However, in my travels, I've gone east to college and I finished at Stanford. And my feelings have always been centered at the University of Alaska. I regret that I haven't kept up with the college as much as I would like to have. I once wrote a scientific paper for the chemistry department. Unfortunately, the professor told me what he thought the answer should be, and I did have a skill in mathematics, and I was able to contrive with help to get the graphs and things to come out right by working from the answer he predicted back to the things that I should have done. And I felt that this paper was such a fraud that I made a special trip back here in 1935 and stole it out of the library. So you'll never see it. But it labeled the hydrogen ion concentration in deteriorating milk. I don't know what that had to do with anything, except if you were deteriorating milk with, I think it was formaldehyde, it would make it appear to be fresher longer. I would like to say that since my sister came here in the second year of the university, my home was always resounding with the cries of admiration and other sort of severe and great things going on at the university. So I got to know all of these older men. When I arrived here at the tender age of 16, for the only purpose to play basketball, which I did, I was part of the university team which won more games than they have for quite a long time since. And they also managed to import two professionals. And that has been my game all my life, and I played basketball with extreme vigor until I was 40. And then they began to move in the tall men, so it was impossible for me to score as much as I'd like to. And so I gracefully quit and retired. The campus, the dormitory, originally I think housed both men and women, the one that they had. The rest of the people largely lived in Fairbanks and commuted here daily on what was called the Brill car. It was a gasoline-operated trolley, if somebody referred to it, that ran from the Fairbanks Depot to the college, where they deposited the students, and there was a long 40 below zero walk up and off of a long hill, trailing past the president and up into the main building, and then it would be going back the other way at night. Now, there were some braver students, Combs and Loftus amongst them, who would live in a log cabin nearby. I don't know where they lived. Campus life at the time, I think, is only an extension backwards of the present life. There were students then, I think, more than now, suffered hardship from lack of money and lack of other forms of support in getting their education. And true to what the president of your local chapter said, many of them didn't finish their 4 years of school in 4 years. Many of them took 10 to finish it, but many did. I think, folks, that it's hard for me to say all of the nice things that you'd want me to say, except I'm proud that I did come here 1 year, and I've always claimed to be in the class of 31, though I didn't graduate. Now, if anyone has a few questions to ask, I'm glad to try to answer them.
Carter,
is
there enrollment?
When I came to college, I'd say it's 40 or 50. Yes, there was. The university basketball team made a tour through southeastern Alaska, as well as Seward, Valdez, and Cordova. And I'm sure that they managed to bring a few students to Fairbanks. And that's about the only creditable thing that the basketball team did for the university. And their level of sportsmanship matched that extant in Fairbanks at the time. The game was so rough that a score of 30 for the winning side and 25 to 28 for the loser would be considered quite a score. I can remember in later years scoring much more than that myself. But basketball grew, and then the next thing you did was bring the big giants, and it ceased to be, in my opinion, a real representative sport. Like many American universities, I hope you guys haven't gone in yet for recruiting men just because they're athletes. And unless they're scholars. I believe the university is here for the purpose of teaching people something more than how to bounce a ball and throw it. I would like to think, and I had a son once who was an All-American football player. I used to think that the only reason that he went to college was to get his education, which he managed to do honorably and win a scholarship to England. But there are very few of the people that can manage to keep up their studies and play a high-grade game of ball. My answer to those who ask me is that I would like to see sports relegated to the intramural stage. Now, if you have to go out to get your students to come here, I think it should be a better show than the basketball. Anybody else have a question?
Although you were here 1 year and then you transferred to Stanford, or?
I went to the Little Life and I went to a theological seminar.
Okay. How was your education here at those days when we had a small school? Did it compare reasonably well? Were you
it was better than the seminary. I managed to get all A's and B's at the seminary in 26 semester credits, about 52 credits in 1 year. Here I did well, and I got the only D of my college career here from my basketball coach. We had a running battle, and I'll tell you how I won the battle. He came back to Anchorage at the beginning of World War II, and my father-in-law of those days, I've had several, the old man was running the USO for the big post that was building up in Anchorage at the time. And Abel came there to work. Kenneth W. Abel was his name. He came there to be my father-in-law's assistant at the USO. In about 6 months, he'd undermined the old man, the old man was sent to Sitka. And Abel was about ready to take over the job as director. And I knew General Buckner rather well at the time, so I called him on the phone, and Abel and his wife left Anchorage within 48 hours. That's how I got even with the coach. Any other stories? Yes.
Would you mind telling me the name of your camp drop?
How about Hood? Would that be right? No, but it'd have to be Hood. Now, who is the gentleman that is? How about the gentleman that studied the Aurora Borealis, the first one? Oh, you see, you fellows are so young. Well, he died, and I'm sure that Professor Hood was, and he worked this out with Mr. Abel so that I could do this. In lieu of doing chemistry, I could do this marvelous study. And if I'd have stayed here much longer, I wouldn't have been worth a hoot, because when I got to Stanford, I really came up against it, and I had an awful time. Now, the university here, I'm sure, has grown academically. But when I first came here, in all honesty, it was just a little more better than a high school, truly. And the academic standing of the professors, even then, President Bunnell hadn't gotten his honorary doctor's degree yet. So, the dean had a master's degree in something or other, and that was just about the size of it. And I'm pleased to note now that many of your professors are PhDs and masters in one field or another. And actually, I think the university has to have a balanced program, but it's academics first and athletics second to me. Mrs. Belkey's mother and I had an argument once about my son, who was the athlete at the University of Colorado. And I said, well, the guy's a good student too, but I forgot what it was about. I thought she was demeaning the athlete, you see. Folks, I've talked long, and I've talked 10 minutes, so I'd try to answer any more.
See if we can find a picture here of the 1930s. There's a few more buildings in those days, but not too many of them that our students of today would recognize. The old Main, well, there's one building that, when I was a student, it was the library upstairs and the gym downstairs, and later on it was the museum. Now they use it for storage. That's in the picture. Club and Main Dorm are here. Hess is here. And another smaller building in the background. Of course, Dr. Bunnell's house is out there.
Well, you see here,
late 30s.
This was
gone. Yeah.
And this was the gym in the upstairs part of this building.
So that was the first gym. See, you learn something new every day.
And Eielson's building was started after I left him.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he wasn't dead.
In fact, one time I tried to tell somebody that Unit 5, which was a frame house built type building when I was a student, sat next to Eielson building. I told him at one time it was on top of Eielson building, and I thought I was crazy until I showed him a photograph of it. Well, Woody Johansson, as I mentioned earlier, actually graduated in 1940, but he was a student here in the 30s. And when I came here in the 50s, he was on the faculty, and he left the faculty while I was a student and joined, I think it was the Bureau of Parallel Ruts, wasn't it, Woody? Or, I mean, Bureau of Public Roads? No, it wasn't that then? Well, that was one of the names that organization had down through the years. This time I'd like to have Woody Johansson from the class of 1940.
I feel as though I'm really pinch hitting for Bill Cashin, who would have really been a historian of this period. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us, so I'll try and do the best I can. I should give you probably a background. My background before coming here, to give you some idea of my impressions of the university when I arrived. I was born and raised in Cordova, which at that time was a railroad town, And my reason for coming to the university was to become a railroad engineer, that is, a civil engineer on a railroad. As I said, told many times that it shut down before I graduated. And so I became a highway engineer instead. But in those days, in 1933, when I first came, incidentally, it took me more than 4 years to graduate also. In those, in 33, you came to Fairbanks by train or over the highway, over the Richardson Highway. And it was a two-day trip from Seward, usually stopping overnight at Curry. When we arrived in early September, of course it was beautiful here. Of course I missed the mountains and the ocean and everything, but here was beautiful farms. And on the first day I was here, Joe Flackney, who was a popular man about the campus at that time, decided to take us to town. We went to town by means, or by way rather, of the Farmers Loop Road, which, and in a horse-drawn wagon. And so we had an enjoyable time looking at all the farms that did exist along there then. And of course, when we got to town, we had to find a way home, and so we walked home on the railroad track, which of course was a way that many people commuted between Fairbanks and the university. When you arrived here by train at the foot of the hill, I don't know if you can see it on this picture or not, but down here there was a depot, a railroad depot, where when you arrived, of course, as incoming students, you were met by a welcoming committee, together with an old truck. I think it must have been about a 1920 vintage, which was the baggage truck. So they did take your baggage for you, but you walked from there, as Howard Rummick said, you walked from there up to the school. At that time, the buildings on campus was the main building, really, and some dormitories. In the main building, there was a power plant. There were the shops. There was the administrative section. There was the... They had just moved the gymnasium to the new building. And so we used the gymnasium as a place to get our instruction in military science. There was another building on campus, a very important one, which was the garage, believe it or not, in which the university kept three or four trucks, and of course the president's Buick sedan. There was a men's dorm, of course, where I stayed, and then there was a girls' dorm, which was to the west of it. And actually, the girls' dorm was not only a dormitory, it also was a restaurant, and it was a dining hall. And, of course, in order to finance my stay at the university, I was at the campus butcher. And it's a rather interesting story. I was asked while in Cordova if I knew anything about butchering, and I said, oh, sure. And so then when I was told that I had a job up here as a butcher if I wanted, of course, then I went to the meat market, and I studied the diagrams on how they butchered beef. And so the meat that students received in 33 and 34 were interesting cuts, but they were hard to identify. Of course, as Howard mentioned, Dr. Bunnell's home was situated right here and on the main entrance to the campus. And I've often wondered since if the location of that house was strategically located to keep track of what went on at the campus, because you couldn't come in or go out without going past his house. And of course, as you can see in the photograph, there was no such a thing as lawns around here. In fact, in the early 30s, there were woods located as close to the campus as probably the Student Union building. And we used to go hunting grouse and rabbits back there. It was pretty good hunting. And then just a little more to the west were the buildings where Professor Fuller, as far as I know, started the first research on the aurora. And he had a series of buildings there that he employed some of the students in order to take readings and measurements and so forth. And this was in the year of about 1933. Of course, I always remember the campus in those days as a place where I worked. And in addition to being the butcher, I was a handyman around the kitchen. And of course, about the 10th of September, it was time to dig potatoes. And this, which looks like a field, well, probably this section of it was a potato field. That's where the potatoes for the university were raised. And unfortunately, when I started, about the time I started digging potatoes, it started snowing. And so my impression of the college and my thoughts of home, well, the thoughts of home became very, very appealing. Another thing I'd like to mention is I read so frequently about the Muskox Range and about the wonderful things that have been done recently with the Muskox. And it burns me a little bit, because when I was a student here, before I was a student, the area between the College Road and the Farmer's Loop was a fenced area in which muskox roamed. And these animals were brought here by what was then the federal government, the Biological Survey. And they were experimenting to see if they could propagate them in this area. And I always, when I think of the muskox, think of Ivor Scarland. Dr. Scarland was hired as a hunter. And his purpose was to shoot the bears. The bears would get into this area. And of course, strange as it may seem, one blow of their paw would crush a skull of a muskox, and so they killed a number of them. So it was to the benefit of the Biological Survey to hire a hunter, and Dr. Scarland was the hunter to protect the muskox from the bear. Of course, at that time, a very substantial part of the university was the university farm. And this had been an experiment station in about the early 30s. It was actually put under the control of the university, and or the college, I should say. And Dr. Bunnell, of course, trying to save money, was utilizing every bit of produce that he could produce on that farm. And so all of the milk that we used at the campus of those days came from the cows on that farm. And of course, all of the experimental produce and that vegetables of various sorts was also utilized as food at the university. And of course, the thing I remember vividly, of course, is the meat. Now, being an amateur butcher, I will say that they did slaughter the animals down at the farm, and then they would present them to me at my little meat cutting house behind the girls' dormitory, the whole carcass.
And summer work. This lasted until that eventful day in December 7th, 1941, which initiated the entrance of the United States into World War II. From that point on, the feeling of uncertainty began. The student body declined rapidly as enlistments and the draft took its toll. The uncertainty of keeping the doors open as an educational institute also existed as President Bunnell fought to obtain financial support from the territorial legislature, private sources, and his own personal finances. During the construction period of what is now Fort Wainwright, the university housed also contingents of the Army, so that the atmosphere had a much different flavor, a sort of a mixed one of campus and military life. After an absence of almost 3 years, I returned in December 1945 to find that somehow things had survived at the campus, and things somewhat remained the same, except for a badly depleted student body. This situation started to change with the fall semester of 1946 as the GI Bill started its impact. The student body showed a steady increase through the latter 40s, but proper funding for much needed physical facilities was still a major problem. I finally graduated in 1947. Graduating class probably wasn't the biggest, and it probably wasn't the smallest in the university's history. I think there were five of us. Myself, Ben Atkinson, for which the power plant is currently named, who is now deceased. Another man named Forrest Cook, and I have no knowledge of where his whereabouts. Grace Bird Scheibel, who is currently a lawyer in town, and Ted Cox, who is currently an accountant in town. To my knowledge, that was the graduating class from 1947. The ability to keep this institution alive during these fitful 40s was primarily due to the faith and perseverance of Dr. Bunnell, who was a president, a postmaster, a janitor, a bank for loan applicants, and whatever other function needed to be performed. It's quite unusual to go to a university to come mail day to find out the president of the university is putting out the mail. And he was putting out the mail because he was the postmaster of college, and this was his function. It's not quite uncommon to see him cleaning up, as a janitor would do. In other words, he performed every task that he thought needed to be done, and no task was too small for him to do. In retrospect, I wouldn't have changed the experience at all. And I do not feel deprived from a lack of a physical facilities at the university educational level. I feel that I did receive a good basic education and other values that were learned that were having a lasting effect on my life. If anybody has any questions about the fitful 40s, I'd be pleased to answer them if I can. Thank you.
As it was approximately the time I arrived around 1954. We have a few more buildings in the picture, and we even have Faculty Row, which I think most of which has been moved since that time. The old log cabin back here that was Dean Hosley's, powerhouse grown a little bit. Kent Hall is in the picture. Old Beth's dorm, which for many years after it left campus was down near what is now the Chevron station and college, was made over from a dorm into apartments, which housed several married students.
for several years until they tore it down again. In fact, I think they burned it down, didn't they? Yeah, it's a controlled burn. Speaking of the dorms, I can recall as a student living in the basement of old Main Dorm, and in the spring you didn't have to worry about washing your feet. All you had to do was dangle over the edge of the bed because there was usually some water on the floor. But we made it through. Some character by the name of Klaus Noske came into the university back in the 50s, and since then he left the university for a while, and he came back and became a history professor, and he's written two or three books since then, either on his own or in conjunction with other people, which he keeps badgering me to buy a copy of every now and then. I already own two or three of them, Klaus, so I've been listening a little bit. He doesn't know it, but I'm working on a book on how to write a proposal. I'm going to teach that guy how to write one yet. So someday he'll have to buy my book. Klaus Noske.
I graduated from the Palmer High School in 1956, and got my first job with the Alaska Road Commission in May of that year. I went to a short training course in Anchorage, and then we were dispatched into the field where I spent most of that year. And in November of 1956, at the end of that month, we finally were laid off because the snow was too high. We were doing some work up at King Mountain on the Glen Highway. And I was back on the farm, unemployed and not liking it too well. And sometime in early January of 57, a number of my high school friends said, let's go up to the University of Alaska. You can get a steam heated room, and a meal ticket for all of that will cost you $400 for 4.5 months. And that's a way to wait out the next construction season. So we had no idea. I'd never seen a university. I was born in Germany and came here as a young lad. And so we piled into a car from the balmy climes of Palmer and came into Fairbanks after diving all night early morning in January. And it was must have been 40 or 50 degrees below zero, kind of weather I'd never experienced up to that point. So we went up to college and enrolled, and we'd take a number of tests. I remember I flunked mathematics, but passed English, much to my amazement. And I was assigned to Norland Hall. Norland Hall was supervised by Jack Distad, who at that point had 12 howling dogs, whom he fed was salmon. So the whole dormitory smelled of salmon. I've since been told that it was only two dogs, but it certainly seemed like a whole dozen. I was assigned to a roommate, and I only saw him sleeping for the first couple of weeks, and then disappeared, and apparently he went into the Navy and has since long since retired. I discovered soon that I had to, for my steam-heated room and meal ticket, I also was expected to take courses. So I enrolled in 15 hours, and I rapidly dropped a number of those, and I think I wound up with about 9 or even 6 at the end of the semester. It wasn't all that memorable, really. The Constitutional Convention had been held on campus very recently, and Old Main Dorm, where the heating facilities were, just had switched to the cafeteria was switched over to Constitution Hall, what is now called Constitution Hall. And so this first semester, I think I wound up, I had a B in English, and all the others I don't remember and really don't want to remember all that much. And I set off and to my construction season, really not having that much enthusiasm to come back to the university. But of course it got cold again in the fall, and there was no place else to go. And once again I wound up here at college. And then I started to take some courses I really enjoyed. Don Moberg was in political science. I remember him, he dressed rather bizarre, we thought. He had received a degree from the University of London, I think, and he had
a little beret and a sort of red vest and various other things. And then we had, I forgot, in my first semester, Lola Tilly tried to recruit me my first day into home economics. I went to the receptions because she served good teas and cookies, and that was rather pleasant. I took courses from Ivor Scarland, who was another campus character, and Major Barry, who was in charge of ROTC, tried to recruit me into ROTC. I told him that I was not a citizen at that point, and had no intention really of getting to the military, but he was a very persistent guy. I got acquainted with Doc Wilson, who was the chemistry professor here, and his dog Puppy, who turned out to be a huge beast, rather good-natured, however. And I started to, I took courses from Herman Slotnick, and I started to enjoy school, much to my surprise. And soon I got a job. You know, you really lived, there were, as other speakers have said, very few people. I can't remember anyone who was supported from home, one exception. Most of us had to work our way through as best as we could. And fairly soon I got a job as campus photographer, which gave me a very nice warm laboratory in the Eielson building. And I could work pretty much at my own leisure. I only had to go to all the occasions when very important people came to Fairbanks. Also became acquainted, other speakers have pointed out, the very close relationships which existed between faculty and student. I remember President Patty and his wife used to come down to Constitution Hall in the basement. There was a little cafeteria or a little snack bar, coffee shop. And they would sit there in the evenings for hours on end and would talk with the students. The same was true with most faculty members. Harry Groom, who was a roguish professor of geology, I never took geology, but he was a very good photographer, and I spent unending hours in his home, and he taught me his craft. He has since deceased under very interesting circumstances. I took classes from Lee Salisbury. He was to rid me of my German accent. He tried hard, unsuccessfully, obviously. I took courses from Minnie Wells, and I always remember sitting in class. She had always dressed in black and smoked quite a few cigarettes. And she had a cigarette holder, and the ashes would get alarmingly long. And as students, you always, you know, you would forget what she was saying, and you focus on these ashes when they were going to fall, as inevitably they would, and fall on her pants, and you know, she had these spots on her pants. I went to school with, in time, President Patty became sponsor of my naturalization proceedings in town, where the Daughters of the American Revolution gave me a little flag, and after the ceremony was over, and told me to be a good citizen and not to get into trouble. And in time, then some other interesting faculty members came. I remember we had a dean of students, Edward Wolses, who was a rather bizarre individual, competently assisted by Betty Lister Watson. Well, Betty Lister was unmarried when she first came here, and all males knew what ailed her. And eventually she got hold of a fellow named Watson and got married, and she calmed down immediately. We also had some interesting students. I remember one time in the main dorm in the wintertime, there were double windows, and there was no prohibition against drinking then, but people would keep their beer cold in these in the space between the two windows, or they'd have caribou or moose meat hanging up. And one time there was excitement in the main dorm because one of the students had gone a little bit off his rocker, and he was hunting silverfish with a 45 caliber pistol. So the old dormitory reverberated to the blasts of his sidearm, as he turned on the light suddenly to surprise the silverfish and, you know, let him have it, and then we turn it off again to surprise him the next time. We also had Sunday dinners, for instance. It wasn't, it became a tradition at which was quite festive with candles. And remember one time one of the students played, he was hired by the food service to play piano. Incidentally, I always thought that the food was extremely good. I never complained about it, having come from Eastern Europe where there really wasn't any food at all. I mean, besides potatoes, that was about it. And one of the students played piano during the dinner hours. He later became a member of the legislature, and somehow he got into a scrape and somebody shot him in the head, which prompted one faculty member to say that he was so dumb he wouldn't have known what hit him anyway. I went to school with interesting people. Kenneth Lowney, who was a an Aleut student, had gone to various boarding schools, one in Klutna, and he became a civil engineer and has been was DOT for many years now, and he's a bridge engineer. Charlie Smeltzer was a fellow student of mine. He just retired as head of the ROTC. I was a little late, I think, in life because I have many years to go before I retire. So these guys did it right. So Charlie retired recently. Don Rosen, who runs Donnybrook, was a fellow student of mine. He went fitfully to school on and off, and he came down with arthritis very badly. And in fact, I guess at one time he thought he wasn't going to make it, but then remarkably recovered, and eventually graduated also. I went to school with Hank Kaiser, who used to brag that he served under four presidents before he got his bachelor's degree, certainly a record of some sort. He also was remarkable in many ways. He had a heart condition, and he hitchhiked out to the Mayo Clinic, which was no small feat then, and got a major heart operation, and he used to show off his scars. Which was, you know, we always admired the very extensive scar that he had. I went to school with Bernie Mueller, who was the environmental head of the environmental division at the state right now. He was behind me a little bit, I think. Ray Nesbitt was a fellow student as well. He's a lawyer in Anchorage now. And we also went to school with the Ivies, Jerry and Bernard Ivy. We lived, I married in 19, met my wife here on campus, my future wife in 1959, and we married in 1960. We lived in the student, married student dormitory. The walls were very thin, and all of us shared very intimately the trials and tribulations of first years of marriage. There were a lot of tears and recriminations. Also, some of us had trap lines running up to President Patty's house, where we snared snowshoe bunnies to supplement our diet. Most of us had cars which didn't run in the wintertime. We used the trunks to stash them with various wild meats that we managed to snag during the hunting season. It was a rather, you know, I'd never been to any university, so when I was in Parma, I mean, the few people who had any money, they would go out to Seattle and attend school. The territory certainly didn't spring to our assistant and said, you know, the poor students here, they want to go to college, so let's stick a community college here. That wasn't the case at all. When I came, our enrollment was 590. Students, most of them, the majority, the probably 500, were males, much to everybody's dismay, and about 90 were women. Some of them were not the prettiest, as I recall. I finally graduated. It took me 4.5 years to get my degree in 1961. I was a little apprehensive when I left here. I had planned to go to graduate school. Well, I really didn't have any great plans at all. And But my first plan was to get a motorcycle, load my wife in the back, and go to South America on a great trip. She was not all that excited about it, although she never told me until many years later. And eventually wound up at the University of Michigan, which had a student population, well, it was 1962, of 29,000. And I thought, you know, my God, these are all, I started graduate study in history, and these are all students from the East Coast and the big universities, and how would I ever know what, you know, what they were talking about? But much to my surprise and satisfaction, I realized that I knew as much, and perhaps in some areas a little bit more than the folks that I went to graduate school with. So I think in retrospect, I feel that it may have been not, you know, the greatest education you get here, but you had this close relationship with the faculty, and of course it depended on what you put in, too. And I seemingly got a very good education because I stacked up all right with all the folks from the big Eastern universities, and didn't have to be ashamed to come from the University of Alaska. Although, when I first applied for graduate school, the University of Idaho turned me down because they said that I came from a culturally impoverished area, and the University of Utah wrote me a letter in Pidgin English saying that I had to realize that they talked English there, and that the currency used were dollars. So I didn't pursue that particular university any further, and opted for the University of Michigan. So in retrospect, I think it was a, you know, the campus certainly was primitive. I mean, if you look at, as far as physical education facilities were concerned, there was the library on top and the gymnasium underneath. The library had, I think, something like 12 or 14,000 volumes. I remember Herman Slotnick was working on his degree, and he constantly had to have something on the French Revolution, and all his materials had to be brought in by interlibrary loan. We never had those problems because, you know, for whatever we were studying, there were enough sources available on campus at that point. What I enjoyed particularly, I think, was the close relationship between the faculty and the students that existed at that point. And another benefit, I think, that has accrued to me over the years is that wherever I go in Alaska today is, you know, I meet somebody with whom I have gone to school. In fact, I took my son on various trips this past summer, and wherever we stopped, be it in Circle on the Yukon or Central, or wherever we went, Anchorage, Palma, there are people I've gone to school with. And he was utterly amazed that I seemingly knew everybody in Alaska, which isn't the case, but apparently many of the people who went to school here have wound up in rather respectable and responsible positions over the years. So I had a very good time, and I've been very fond of this university ever since. And after I finished my graduate studies in 1969, I'd fond hopes that I would be able to wind up my declining years here. And much to my surprise and delight, Herman Slotnick offered me a job in the history department, and that's why I've been ever since. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
When was Brooks Hall built? It was a creation of the 50s, wasn't it?
Well, it was here already when I came. Harry Groom, you know, was hung out in Brooks. There were some, you know, some interesting antics that, I don't know if famous incident where Harry Groom and one of his graduate students concocted the story that the books range was erupting and everyone was ready to jump in by parachute and try to stem the disaster, and it was a really good story, but he was full of pranks like that.
The demise was prank too.
Oh, it was amazing, and that's a story that Lee Salisbury really tells well. Harry Groom eventually divorced his wife and married somebody of means, apparently, and became a photographer full-time. And
And he said to someone way over to England that if he should die, he'd like to be buried at sea. And the long and the short of it is that he did die on that voyage, and he was buried at sea, but his coffin came up three times and was dredged up, by a seiner or dragger or whatever it was. And finally, the whole thing resulted in a suit, in a lawsuit, because the undertaking establishment had not used the lead-lined coffin that had promised, so there would be weighted enough and, you know, keep the guy at the bottom. But he bobbed up three times. This typical Harry Glue. I don't know, I didn't have any classes from him.
He came home one night to find his wife at the door pointing the sidearm at him and pulling the trigger, but she realized it was unloaded. Unfortunately, it was.
It was unloaded? All right, well, thank you.
Taken in the 1960s, and with all the controversy we have about this place called the, what are they calling this place out here now? The Constitution Plaza. There's been some people say, well, why don't they just cover the darn thing with concrete and use it for a parking lot? Well, if you'll look closely in this picture, you'll see about 40 cars parked in that same spot. Brings us up to the 1960s. Thinking back when I was a student, Klaus, I can remember when the basement of Old Main Dorm during hunting season became the cutting room, and you always had to sort of watch it if you happened to be on the basement level of Main Dorm, because you went out in the hall and you never know how deep the blood was going to be out there from the slaughtering out there. But we had a lot of fun anyway. Actually, the next gentleman we have on the list, as I mentioned earlier, I understand he started his college career about 1953, and as typical of many of us, took a little bit longer than the prescribed 4 years, and finally made it in 1966. And someplace along the line, he got into some kind of a discussion at a bar, as the story goes, and the outcome was what was later known as the Great Alaska Raft Race. Merritt Helford.
I don't want to talk about the raft race because that was after I graduated. I think back to the 60s. Actually, I started just shortly after Klaus did. And we shared a period of the university's history together. I arrived in Fairbanks in 1958 and continued on and graduated finally in 1966. Your comments about my start in 1953, I had a lot of trouble with college when I first started, and I proceeded to not do things and get thrown out of my ear. And by the time I arrived at the University of Alaska, it was my fourth college, and then I proceeded to get thrown out of my ear and returned the next year and fought against the abysmal GPA that I had established in the first year, and ended up with something that was fairly reasonable by the time I graduated.